Lecture number 4. 24th of December, 1976, at the Bhagwan Shivajni Sashram, Pune.
The first question. Why do you refer to God as He? The isness, the life energy, the totality, the unknowable. Well, would not it be clearer to call God it? What bugs me about the He is that He implies a personality, a will, a judgmental authority, and my ability to love is crippled enough without that obstacle. Well, I see now that the question is an entry into my problem. How can I trust or come to love your authority? God is not expressible in any word whatever. Call Him He, and the word falls short. Call Him She, and the word falls short. Call Him It, and the word falls short, very short. If He reminds you of personality, it will remind you of a thing. If He reminds you of the male, she will remind you of the female. Because all words are created by human beings for human use, and God is not a human creation. So whatsoever you call Him is going to be only symbolic. Choose any symbol you like. If you feel like calling Him It, call Him It. But remember, it has its own limitations. It is used for things, for dead things. And it has another limitation. It is very neutral. It is not responsive. If you say something to it, there will be no response. Only a person can respond. And love needs a response. You can talk to a wall, but there will be no response. It will be a monologue. God is called He, so that your prayer can become a dialogue. Otherwise it will be monologue and mad. The it cannot answer it. The it cannot be responsive. The it cannot care about you. The it is neutral. Whether you pray or not makes no difference. Whether you worship or not makes no difference. Whether you are or are not makes no difference. The it will be very stony. If He is creating trouble, it will create more trouble, mind you. How can you love the it? You can purchase the it. You can use the it, but how can you love it? In that way, He seems to be the best. For many reasons, let me explain it to you. First, it gives a personality to God. God becomes a person, alive, beating with a heart, breathing, pulsating. You can call Him, and you can trust there will be a response. You can look at Him, you can feel Him, and you can trust that He will also feel for you. The personality helps you to commune, to pray, to relate. If God has no personality, it will be so beyond you, it will be inconceivable. You are a person. You need a God who is a person too. Because you can relate only to a person. Unless you have become an impersonal being, you cannot relate to an impersonal being. Religions have existed, particularly in the East, Buddhism, Jainism, which don't talk about God at all. But then they cannot talk about prayers, and they cannot talk about love. The moment they drop the idea of God, of a personal God, of a creator, of somebody there who can look at you, hold your hands, embarrass you, the moment they drop the idea of a personal God, they had to drop the idea of prayer as a corollary, as a necessary corollary. Worship has to be dropped, prayer has to be dropped. Singing, dancing has to be dropped. Because for whom you sing and for whom you dance, there is nobody, only stony eyes all around. And existence is so vast, you talk, why not call isness? How you will relate with isness? It will be so vast, you will not be able to embrace it. With the He, God becomes as small as you are. You can hold His hand. The hand of isness is not possible. With He becomes warm. Isness is cold. Existence is cold. You will freeze. Jainism, Buddhism dropped the idea of God because of these problems. Philosophical, philological, problems that arise out of language and grammars, logic, they drop the idea, the very idea. But then prayer disappears. And Jainism became poor for that. Meditation remains. Very lonely efforts. Have you watched it? You can meditate alone. You can pray together. Prayer is a communion. Christians, Mohammedans, Jews, they know what prayer is. Jainism, Buddhism completely lost track of prayer. And prayer has a beauty of its own. A meditator seems to be closed in himself. He has no opening. He is thrown to himself in a deep aloneness. Silent he can become, but ecstatic he cannot become. Ecstasy happens only when there are two. Love happens only when there are two. When you are alone, you can be silent, still. But you cannot be throbbing with joy. You cannot dance. The Sufi dances because he calls God. He can invoke God in a personal way. Jainism and Buddhism became very poor. And when Buddhism spread out of India, it started talking about Buddha as a God. And through Buddha, again prayer entered. In Jainism, prayer never entered, and Jainism could never spread. It remained a very tiny sect, dead. It is inhuman. Isness, existence, totality, big words, but dead. They don't pulsate. How do you relate with totality, tell me? How you will call totality? How you will connect yourself with totality? You will be too tiny, and the vastness of totality is so big, you will be lost. Now God has to be conceived in a human way. To call him he is very human. Yes, by and by, when you approach him, you learn him, you imbibe him, there will be no need one day to call him he. You can drop that. Once the contact is made, once your boundaries and his boundaries are no more separate, when your boundaries and his boundaries have blended into one existence, then there will be no need. You can simply bow down without even using a single word. You can simply sit in silence and prayer will be there. You will be praying without any prayer. But that is a later development. In the beginning, you will be at a loss if you don't call him by any personal name, if you don't make him personal. Now, there are two possibilities. Either you call him he or you call him she. Both have been used. Sufis call him she, the beloved, feminine. Christians, Jews call him he, the male, the lover. These two are the possibilities. It depends on you. Both have different qualities. The moment you call him he, it means you need not go in search for him. He will come. He is the male. And that is the beauty of it. The woman can wait and the lover will come. Jews say, you are not only in search of God, God is searching you. That's the beauty of the pronoun he. These are symbolic, significant, can be of tremendous value. Jews say, he is searching you. You can wait like a woman. You can become a tremendous awaiting, just an opening, ready to receive the guest, and the guest is coming because the male comes in search of the female. Sufis call him si, then the whole journey changes. Then you have to seek him. Then you have to find him. Of course, the journey becomes more difficult. If you have to seek God, it seems almost impossible that you will succeed. Where you will seek him? The address is not known. Even if he comes by, you will not be able to recognize him. He will be such a stranger. You have never cognized him, so how you will recognize him? You have never seen him before, so how you are going to decide that, yes, here is God? It is going to be difficult. And where you will go? To Kasi, to Mathura, to Mecca, to Jerusalem, where you will go? To the Himalayas, where you will go? How you will move? What will be your direction? From the very beginning there will be confusion. It is better to wait than to go in search for him. It is better to wait and trust and pray and let him come to you. That is the meaning of calling him he. That he can come. You become the feminine. Then he becomes the male. And the play starts. If you become the male, of course, then it is your responsibility to seek him. The Sufi goes to God. For the Jew, the God comes to him. For the Hasid, the God comes to him. Now it is for you to decide. I am not saying call him he. It is for you to decide. It appears to me that he is more economical, more clever. But if you belong to the women's lib movement, you can call him she. But then you have to understand the implications of it. It is not only a question of grammar. not only a question of philology, language. It is taking a certain attitude. By calling him he, you declare yourself a woman. With that, it is a totally different endeavor. By calling him she, you call yourself a man. Man is aggressive. If you call him she, you will become aggressive. You will start conquering God. Then God will have to surrender to you. How can you surrender to God? Then you will be too much in your male aggressive mind. But if you call him he, you have to surrender to him. He has to come and defeat you and make you victorious in your defeat. He has to come and overpower you and flood you and destroy you, annihilate you and recreate you. My feeling is still this, that call him he. You will be benefited. You will be blessed. And the second question is also there in the first question. Well, I see now that the question is an entry into my problem. How can I trust or come to love your authority? I have no authority. You need not trust my authority. I am just a person, a presence. I am not an authority. I am not proving anything to you. I am not arguing for something. I am not advocating any theory or philosophy. I am not trying to convince you about anything whatsoever. I have no authority because I don't belong to any tradition. Only traditions can have authority. A Hindu has authority from the Vedas, Upanishads, Gita. The Mohammedan has authority from Quran. The Christian has authority from the Bible, from the Pope. Authority comes from tradition. I am non-traditional. I am not claiming any tradition. I am simply here on my own. I have no authority. I cannot say whatsoever I am saying is right because Vedas also say it. I cannot quote. I cannot say whatsoever I am saying is right, has to be right, because Jesus also says the same. Muhammad also says the same. No, I am not taking any support from anybody else. Whatsoever I am saying, I am saying. I know it that way. I have no other authority than myself. I am a presence, a person. You need not trust my authority. I am not an expert. I am a rebel. How can I have any authority? My own experience is all that I have. You can look into me. You can look into my eyes. You can feel me. You can drink me. And that will decide. And this is not going to be a relationship between an authoritative person and one who has no authority. This is not going to be a relationship between a knower and the ignorant. This is not going to be a relationship between a teacher and a student. No, the professor in the university has the authority and the student has to learn from him. He knows what is right and he knows what is wrong, and the student simply has to yield to him. I am not in any way authoritative. I am here. I am a declaration, a revelation. You listen to me. You imbibe me. You drink me. If that very taste decides something, it's okay. If it doesn't decide, then I am not for you. You are not for me. Then say goodbye to me. Then there is no need to hang around here. It will be futile. It is a love affair. When you love a person, you don't ask for the authority. Love is mad. It is crazy. I am here only for those courageous people who can be crazy with me. I exist for the eccentrics. I exist only for the very chosen few, the eccentrics, those who are ready to leave all the boundaries of safety and security, authority and scripture and tradition, who are ready to go with me into the dark, who are ready to go with me and risk. And I am not promising you anything. I cannot promise in the very nature of things. Truth cannot be promised. You have to feel it. Remember, authority appeals to the head, to the reason. I don't appeal to the reason. My appeal is to the heart. The heart does not bother about authority. When you fall in love with a woman, do you ask for authority? Has she any authority from Cleopatra that she is beautiful? You ask certificates. Has she been certified by experts that she is really a beauty? Do you take her to the doctor to examine, to the aesthetic philosopher to decide whether she is really a beauty? No. Even if the whole world says that she is not beautiful, you say, I don't care. I love her and I know she is beautiful. She is beautiful because you love, not otherwise. You don't love her because she is beautiful. She becomes beautiful because you love. I become an authority if you love me, not otherwise. If you are asking for the authority, then you will never love me. Then it is better we take leave of each other, sooner the better. I am not going to produce any authority. I have none. You have to look into the person himself. You have to look in me, my presence. You have to feel it intimately. That's why I say courage is needed, and only courageous can love. Love is the greatest courage in the world, because it cannot depend on anything else. It has to depend just on a hunch. It has to depend on intuition. It cannot depend on intellect. There is no other proof. Love asks for no other proof. And love cannot produce any proof. Jews had to reject Jesus. Why? Because he could not produce the authority. By what authority? They were asking him again and again. By what authority you speak? Who has given you the authority to speak? Who can give authority to a Jesus? And whatsoever he said was absurd. He said, authority? Before Abraham was, I am. Now, Abraham is the most respected prophet to the Jews. And Jesus says, before Abraham was, I am. Even Abraham cannot make me authoritative. I am not following Abraham. I have preceded him. Now this is absurd, because the time gap is so vast. Thousands years before was Abraham. And Jesus says, before Abraham was, ever was, I am. My existence precedes Abraham's. Who can give me authority? And he is right. Because the source that he has touched in himself is eternal. The source he has touched in himself needs no authority to prove it. On the contrary, Jesus becomes the proof that Abraham was right. This is preposterous. That's what I am saying. I am saying, I am the proof that Krishna was right. I am the proof that Buddha was right. I am the proof that Jesus was right, not otherwise. So I have no authority. I am here. Take it or leave it. The second question. My understanding is that knowledge is understanding. The wisdom of the sages is the wisdom of the ages. Please lead me to wisdom. In one question, there are three questions. First, my understanding is that knowledge is understanding. No, sir. Knowledge is never understanding. Knowledge is a deception of understanding. Knowledge is a pseudo-coin, substitute. It is not understanding. Knowledge is borrowed. Understanding is never borrowed. Understanding is yours. Knowledge is always of others. Understanding arises out of your awareness. Knowledge arises out of your learning. And the processes are totally different, diametrically opposite. If you want to understand, you will have to unlearn all that you have learned. Knowledge functions as a barrier. Knowledge has to be dropped. The known has to cease for the unknown to be. Understanding is of the unknown. Knowledge is of the known. Knowledge is your memory. Understanding is your very being. Knowledge is a borrowed light. Knowledge is like the moon. Understanding is like the sun. The moon lives on the borrowed light. It reflects sun rays. It has no light of its own. The sun has its own light. You say, my understanding is that knowledge is understanding. Then you have misunderstood, sir. Second, the wisdom of the sages is the wisdom of the ages. No, not at all. The wisdom of the sages has no relationship with time. It is not the wisdom of the ages. That is a totally different thing. The wisdom of the ages is nothing but the collective knowledge, the collective experience of humanity. People have lived, people have experienced. By and by, they go on deducing some knowledge out of their experience. Masses. The wisdom of the ages comes through the masses. It is a mass product. It comes out of time, out of experience. And the wisdom of the sages never comes out of time. It comes out of timelessness. When a person goes beyond time, then he becomes wise. When a person moves into time, he becomes knowledgeable. An old man is knowledgeable. An old man is not necessarily wise, remember. An old man is not necessarily wise, and a wise man is not necessarily old. Shankaracharya was very young. When he was 33, he died. But he was tremendously wise. Buddha was near about 40 when he became enlightened. Muhammad was near about 40 when he became enlightened. They were facing older people than themselves. That was one of the conflicts. When Buddha came to his own father, of course the father was the father, and as fathers are, the father laughed at their stupidity. He said, "What do you want to teach me? You are my son. I am older than you. I am your father. I have known the world. I have known life, its miseries, its blessings. Certainly I know more than you know." And Buddha said, "That's right, sir. You know more. As far as knowledge is concerned, your memory is far bigger than mine. But I have not brought knowledge to you. I have brought something totally new. A inner light has arisen in me, a flame. And I see you are living in darkness." The father felt hurt. His ego was hurt. He was angry. Certainly, Jesus was very young. And if the old rabbis were not ready to listen to him, it seems absolutely okay. Why they should listen to a young man who has not known the world, who has not lived yet? Jesus was only 33 when he was crucified. He started preaching when he was 30, very young. And suddenly, people had known him working in his father's workshop, cutting wood, polishing wood. He was a carpenter's son. Nobody has ever dreamed that this boy suddenly will become a wise man. Then one day he declares that he is the Messiah, that he is the Son of God. Certainly, how people can believe it? They have known him as a carpenter. He was making furniture for them, and he was doing ordinary jobs in the town, and suddenly he declares, must have gone mad. Remember, it is always wisdom which is crucified on the cross. Because the knowledgeable people cannot tolerate it. It offends. It is offensive. Wisdom is always timeless. It has nothing to do with your life experiences. And what you call wisdom of the ages is totally different. It is a mass product. People have lived on earth so long, and they have experienced many things, and of course they have deduced. They have come to certain conclusions. Wisdom is not a conclusion. It is not out of experience. Wisdom is illumination. Wisdom is revelation. It is sudden, like lightning. It is unproved. It cannot be proved in the very nature of its truth. It cannot be proved. You have to fall in love with it or not. It is so sudden and unrelated with your life situations and experiences. How it can be proved? What proof Jesus can give to you? He gave his own life, but he could not give any proof. Do you remember? The last thing he was asked was by Pilate, the Roman governor. Before he was crucified, the Pontius Pilate asked him, "What is truth?" And Jesus remained silent. He looked into the eyes of the governor, but he didn't say a single word. Why Jesus remained silent? He should have said something, but truth cannot be said. And it is foolish to ask a person like Jesus, what is truth? Because Jesus is truth. He has said many times, I am the truth, I am the way, and I am the goal. Now what is the point of saying? He is standing in front of Pontius Pilate. Truth itself is standing. And the Pilate asks, what is truth? Jesus is not a pandit. He is not a professor. He is not a philosopher. He is not going to give a theory about truth. He is truth himself. He stood there absolutely in silence. He made himself available. He made his presence available. But Pilate could not understand it. He could not see truth. He was hankering for a few words, that this man will say few words. And this man didn't say a single thing, and yet he asserted everything that can be said about truth. He revealed himself. He was there. His presence was there. His vibe was there. If Pilate had been a little receptive, he would have known what truth is. Truth is not out of the experiences of ages. Truth is not an experience at all. When all experiences disappear and only the experiencer is left in pure consciousness, consciousness without content is what truth is. It is not an experience. It is not that you experience something. No, nothing is left to experience. Nothing whatsoever. Just a pure sky. No object. Only the subjectivity. Throbbing with totality. Dancing. Just the subjectivity. Just pure consciousness without any content. It is not an experience. Let me tell you this way. God is not an experience. It is beyond experience. The world is an experience. God is not an experience. Experience is possible in duality only. When I am separate from you, I can experience you. When I am one with you, how I can experience you? How I will divide the experiencer and the experience, the knower and the known, the seer and the seen? No, it is not possible. The subject and object have lost their boundaries. They have become one. Now, who is the knower and who is the known? Wisdom is that lightning where the known and the knower become one. When the seer and the seen become one. When all duality disappears and only one remains. Only one. In experience, the other is needed. The experience is other-based, other-oriented. You say the wisdom of the ages is the wisdom of the sages. It is not. The wisdom of the sages is timeless. It is beyond experience. It is transcendental. And the wisdom of the ages is mundane, temporal, based in experience. And third, please lead me to wisdom. That is not possible. If somebody else leads you, it will be knowledge. Again, you will be trapped in knowledge. Nobody can lead you into wisdom. Because the other will be the cause of knowledge. Only you can be the cause of your wisdom. Then you can ask, what I am doing here? I am not leading you into wisdom. I can do only one thing, a negative thing. I am trying to destroy your knowledge. I am simply removing the hindrance, the barrier. I am simply removing the rock in your path. That's all. And that rock is the knowledge. Once the rock is removed, you will start flowing. The fountain is there, blocked by the rock. Your wisdom is with you. It is your life energy. It is your vitality. It is your elan. It is there. Once you become daring enough to drop knowledge, once you become daring enough to be innocent, daring enough to be ignorant, once you can say, I don't know, once you have gathered that courage to declare that I don't know, and all that I know is just illusory. All my knowledge is borrowed, bogus, empty. The moment you drop your knowledge, wisdom arises. I cannot lead you to wisdom. Wisdom will arise in you. It will well up in your being. Just drop the rock that you are carrying. And that rock is of knowledge. And if you think knowledge is understanding, then how you are going to drop the rock? Then you will protect it. If you think knowledge is wisdom, then of course I will look to you like an enemy who is trying to take your wisdom away. The master can only be negative. The master cannot give you anything positive. And avoid anybody who says to you that he is going to give you something positive. Avoid. The master is just a help to remove the barriers. The master is via negativa. He is the path of negation. He simply takes away. He says, this is not true. This is not true. This is not true. He goes on eliminating. One day suddenly he has taken all props away from you. You collapse. You collapse in wisdom. One day suddenly when all your hindrances have been taken away, something arises in you. Pops in you. Like lightning. That's what wisdom is. It is your innermost nature. It cannot be given to you. There are three types of teachers in the world. One, I call the charismatic. Another, I call the methodical. And the third, I call the natural. These three divisions are also the divisions of therapists too. There are three types of therapists: charismatic, methodical, natural. This division has to be understood. Charisma comes from a Greek word meaning spirit, full of spirit. The charismatic leader is so full of spirit that if you go to him, you will become a slave. He is so full of spirit, he will overpower you. He will not bother about you. He will start dragging you by his own spirit. He will lead you. He will become a leader. I am not a leader. I am not a charismatic master, charismatic teacher. Because a charismatic teacher is dangerous. He kills you. You are nullified. Your being is effaced. To be under the guidance of a charismatic person is like trying to grow under a big tree. Impossible. It is impossible. You may think the tree is protective, but to grow under a big tree is impossible. You see, a big oak, thousands of acorns fall under the oak and die. They never grow. They cannot grow. They may be deluded because they will be under the mother tree and there will be protection. But the protection is poisonous. The acorn has to go far away. has to be independent. Only then it can become a tree. Otherwise it will never become a tree. The charismatic person is dangerous, and people are very much attracted to the charismatic person. The charismatic person is never a true master. He becomes a slave driver. The charismatic is more of a politician than of a religious person. Adolf Hitler is charismatic. Mussolini is charismatic. Leaders are charismatic. They have to lead people. They have to make slaves of people. They have to dominate and dictate. The second type of teacher, master, leader is methodical. He uses methods, not spirit. He will not overpower you by his spirit. He will simply give you methods better than the first, because he will never make you a slave. The word method again comes from a Greek root, which means to follow. The second type of leader, master, teacher will follow the disciples. He will give a method. He will never lead you. He will follow you. The second type of therapist will follow the patient. He will listen to the patient. He will try to find out what the patient's need is. He will listen to the student, to the disciple. He will look at you and he will help you from the behind. He will never be ahead of you. He will push you rather than pulling you. He will not drive you. He will simply persuade you. The second is better. Of course, many people are attracted to the first and very few are attracted to the second. The third is the natural master, the natural healer. He never leads you, he never follows you, he accompanies you. He simply holds your hands. He is a friend. Buddha has said that next time when I will be coming, my name will be Maitreya, the friend. And it is very significant. Buddha says, in his life as Gautam Buddha, he was too charismatic, so full of power, energy, elan, spirit, that he overpowered people. Mahavira was more methodical. And Buddha says, next time when I am coming, my name is going to be Maitreya. Maitreya means the friend. Very symbolically he says, next time I am going to accompany you. I will be a friend. I will not lead you in front of you. I will not push you from the back. I will just hold your hand as a friend. This is the natural. This is the best. And this is most difficult to find, because you feel attracted towards charismatic person, miraculous, or you become attracted towards the methodical. The natural is the best but the least attractive. He is very simple and ordinary. He has no charisma. He does not dazzle you. And he is not very methodical. He is not very technological. He is not very scientific. He is more poetic. He is more chaotic. He is more natural, as chaotic as nature is. I am a natural person. I have no charisma. And I don't believe in charisma. I don't believe in methods. Even if I use, I don't believe in them.
I am a natural person, very ordinary. I can be lost in a crowd and you will not be able to find me. So I don't lead you. I accompany you. I can hold your hand. I can be your friend. The third question. Karl Marx's philosophy advocates classless society and stateless society. Is he advocating a religious society indirectly? Directly or indirectly, he is not proposing any religious society. And the way he proposes how he is going to bring this classless society and a stateless society is really absurd. He proposes through the state itself. He says first the state has to become very dominant, dictatorship of the proletariat. And then one day, when the dictatorship of the proletariat has succeeded, then it will wither away. That is nonsense. Nobody ever wants to leave the power. Once it is there in your hands, nobody wants to leave it. The state will become more and more powerful. The society may disappear, but the state is not going to disappear. That's what has happened in Russia. That's what is happening in China. All Marx's predictions have proved false. Through the dictatorship, no society can come to a point where state will disappear. State will become more and more powerful. And people who will control the state, they will never like. They have never liked. Who likes to lose his power? Power corrupts, and corrupts absolutely. Karl Marx had no understanding of human psychology, human mind. He was acquainted with the structure of the society, with the economic structure of the society, but he was completely unaware of the human structure of the psyche. And that is more important. Because finally that is the decisive factor. He was not aware that Stalin will be born. He was not aware that Mao will be born. In fact, he was thinking America will become the first communist country. And he was wrong. He was thinking a very affluent society, a capitalist society, will become first communist. Because he thought in a capitalist society, the difference between the poor and the rich will be too big, and the poor will revolt. But just the contrary has happened. Two very poor countries have become communist. Russia and China both are very poor. He could not have even imagined Russia ever becoming a communist country. Why not America? In fact, the process has been totally different. The difference between the poor and the rich has not increased. In fact, they have come closer. The poor has become more and more richer in America. The difference exists, but the difference is lesser than ever before. And if American society goes on progressing, one day America will become the first stateless society possible. And the difference is disappearing naturally. Affluence is growing, riches are growing. You are so much greedy about riches because they are so scarce. When everything will be too much there, who bothers to hoard? For what? You don't hoard air, you don't hoard water. If everything else becomes so much available, hoarding will disappear. That is the only natural course. Communism is an abortion. It is unnatural. Capitalism is natural. And capitalism is going to disappear naturally. And that will be a natural death as a man dies on the deathbed, slowly, slowly, slowly. It will not be an accident. A young man suddenly dies out of heart attack or car accident. Natural death is good because out of natural death, natural life is born. I am not in favor of Karl Marx. And in fact, he himself was not a proletariat. He himself was quite rich. In fact, to think about communism, one needs to be quite rich. He remained in the British Museum his whole life, sitting, doing nothing, reading books. I have heard an anecdote. In the communist heaven, the equivalent of St. Peter stopped one applicant at the gate and asked, "What are your qualifications for entering here?" "Well," said the man, "on earth my father was a rich industrialist. My mother came from a family of middle-class tradesmen. Me, I was a successful writer. And finally, after inheriting a large sum of money, I married a baroness." The gatekeeper was choking with rage by this time. "And those are your claims for entering our communist heaven?" He spluttered. Meekly the applicant added one more line. "I thought my name might help me," he murmured. "It is Karl Marx." Marx was not a poor man. Even to dream about communism, one needs to be affluent. Even to dream about utopias. Communism is a byproduct, not of proletariat's thinking, but of middle-class people. The middle-class people are the most frustrated people in the world. The poor is not frustrated. He is poor and settled. And the rich is not frustrated. He is rich and settled. The middleman is very frustrated. He wants to be rich, and he hopes he can be rich, and he feels the poverty like a shadow following him. He is in the limbo. The middle class man is the most dangerous man. He is poor and rich both. And he does not want to be poor, and he wants to be rich. If he cannot be rich, then he would like to destroy the whole society. He would like nobody to be rich. And a miracle is happening in America. The rich is disappearing and the poor is disappearing and the middle class is becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. Just the opposite was the idea of Marx. He was thinking that rich will become richer and poor will become poorer, and by and by the middle class will be divided in two parts. Those who are rich will move to the rich, and those who are poor will fall down into the poverty, and the society will be absolutely cut into the poor and the rich, and that will be the inevitable moment of revolution. This has not happened. This is not happening. Just the contrary is happening. The middle class is becoming bigger and bigger. The richer are one extreme of the middle class now, and the poor are another extreme of the middle class now. The middle class is the only class now. And this middle class is going to become the classless society sooner or later. Classless society is going to come, but not through Marx. It is going to come through a totally natural process of capitalism, not through communism. And Marx certainly was not a religious person at all. He was against religion. He was not really acquainted with religion. All that he knew about was Judaism and Christianity. He was a Jew. And this is something to be understood. Marx is Jew, Freud is Jew, Einstein is Jew. The three great names of the modern world are all Jews. Jews have suffered so much, they are very angry. And their anger comes in so many garbs. Marx's anger against society, in fact, is Jewish anger against the non-Jewish world. And he knew only Judaism and Christianity, which are not very developed religions. Had he known anything about Buddhism, or Patanjali, or Upanishads, his ideas would have certainly been different. But he was not aware. And he was not, in fact, even trying to become aware. His religious understanding was very poor. He was an economist. Religion has nothing to do with society. That's why he was against religion. Religion is individualistic. And he was a socialist par excellence. That's why he said religion is the opium of the masses. Religion is individual. Because religion believes in individual freedom. And the flowering of the ultimate is going to be individual, not social. You have never heard of a society becoming religious. Only individuals, a Buddha here, a Jesus there, a Moses somewhere else, only individuals have become religious. The society can never become religious. Because the crowd mind cannot come to that flowering. To be religious is such a tremendous growth. It is the opening of your ultimate potential. It cannot be of the mass. You don't think that one day the masses will become great painters like Picasso or Leonardo da Vinci. You don't think that one day great masses will become musicians like Beethoven, Mozart or Wagner. You don't think that masses one day will become great mathematicians like Einstein, Planck, Eddington. No, you don't think that way. Then why do you think masses one day will become great religious geniuses like Buddha, Jesus, Moses, Mahavir, Muhammad? It is not possible. The mass lives in a very dark way. It lives in the jungle. Only very few people escape from the jungle and enter into the forest. And only very few of those who enter the forest ever enter into the garden. Many more become too much attached with the forest and they remain there. Let it be this way. One person in 1 million escapes from the jungle ever and reaches to the forest. Out of 1 million in the forest, one escapes from the forest and reaches to the garden. And out of 1 million in the garden, one escapes from the garden and reaches into the home. That has been the proportion up to now. And this is going to be the proportion. Religion is only for the few. It hurts. Because you would like religion to be for everybody. But I cannot help. If music cannot be for everybody, and painting cannot be for everybody, and dancing cannot be for everybody, then excuse me, I cannot help. Religion too cannot be for everybody. And in a communist world, religion becomes impossible because they don't allow individuality, they don't allow freedom. They don't allow any person to be different from the mass. I have heard a Soviet Russian story. A man was seized with a violent cramp in his stomach and sought relief at the modern white structure erected for the purpose in his hometown. Upon entering the building, he found himself in a hall with two doors. One was marked male, the other female. Naturally, he entered the door marked male. He found himself in a room with two doors. One was marked over 21, the other under 21. Since he was 52, he entered the door marked over 21. He found himself in another room with two doors. One was marked serious illness, the other minor indisposition. Since he was doubled up with pain by this time, he staggered through the door marked serious illness. He found himself in a room with two doors again. One was marked non-believers and godless, and the other was marked believers in God, the religious. Since he was a believer in God, he entered the door marked for the religious and found himself on the street. In a communist world, a religious person cannot exist. He is not allowed. A communist world believes in the society and the absolute domination of the society. The individual is thought to be as a danger. Anybody trying to be individual is looked as to be the enemy. One should not try to be an individual. One should follow the crowd. One should be in the crowd. One should not try one's own ways and styles. Even about ordinary things, if you go to China or Russia, even in dress, you will find a uniformity. Even in cars, you will find uniformity. Everything has to be just like everybody else. Nobody should try, even in dress, no one should try any individual style, because that is dangerous. Communism does not allow the individual. How it can allow religion? It is impossible. Religion is individual flowering. Religion can exist only in an individualistic society where freedom is allowed, where freedom to be oneself is allowed, where nobody interferes with you, where you are left alone to yourself, where you can do anything that you want to do with yourself. The society interferes only when you start interfering with other people's lives, otherwise not. If you are not harmful, nobody will interfere with you. This is possible only in a democratic country. This is possible only in a capitalist country. I am all for capitalism, and I am all for democracy. It is better to be poor, but remain democratic. It is better to be uneducated, but remain democratic. Otherwise, your stomachs will be full, but your spirits will be empty. Otherwise, your bodies will get nourishment, but your souls will die, starve. And the second part of the question, if not, what type of social order should there be where man will not be exploited by man? Unless there is more than enough, man will always be exploited by man. It is not a question of communism or socialism or capitalism. Unless there is more than enough, man will be exploited. So create more than enough. Be creative. Use all possibilities to create more. That is first thing. And second thing, live in the present. Don't think of the morrow. Listen to Jesus, he says, look at the lilies in the fields. They spin not, they weave not, they labor not, they don't think of the morrow, yet they are so beautiful. Even Solomon, arrayed in his whole glory, was not so beautiful. Live in the present. The future creates greed. Greed creates hoarding. Hoarding creates poverty. Only a religious society, and when I say religious society, I don't mean a religious social order. I mean by religious society where many, many people are religious. At least striving towards religion. Where many people are meditating, praying. When many people are loving, caring. Where many people have compassion. Where many people are freed from greed and hoarding. Where many people are enjoying life in the present, delighting in the play in the present, and not bothering about the future. Where many people are simply delighted moment to moment, in that society, exploitation will disappear. Otherwise, exploitation is not going to disappear. You can change the structure. In Russia, the old exploiters have disappeared, but the new exploiters have come. And new are more dangerous, because they are more technologically equipped than the first one. The rich people were there, they exploited. The Tsar was there, he was exploiting, but nothing to be compared with Stalin and his company. They are more equipped. The Tsar was not so equipped, that's why the revolution was possible. Now there is no possibility of revolution in Russia. Impossible. You cannot even imagine of any revolution. Because the grip of the state is so great, and the state is so much technologically equipped against the individual, that no individual even can think. It is impossible to talk about revolution. It is impossible to even think, because they say the walls have ears. You cannot talk even to your wife, frankly, because who knows? She may be the informer. You cannot talk to your own child, to your own kids, because he belongs to the Youth Communist Party. And they are teaching their people to be more patriotic, to be more for the country, against the family. The society is the goal, not the family. The family has to be disrupted completely. And there are no more any parties, no more ideologies available, no possibility to publish a book or a newspaper. How you can think in Russia a revolution can happen? No. The state is so powerful. It will crush anybody in the bud. And now what they are doing? First, they used to murder their enemies. Now they don't murder. Now they have more lethal weapons. They brainwash. They don't murder. They simply give electric shocks. Insulin shocks, and they brainwash the man. And the man comes from the hospital, not from the prison, back home, completely idiotic, stupid. He has forgotten all that he knew. He cannot even think. He cannot put two sentences logically. He has to learn from ABC again. Now how can you think about a revolution? Sooner or later in a communist country it is going to happen. Because the children have to be born in the hospital, immediately the child is born, they will put an electrode in the head. That will do. Then the government will know always what you are thinking even, not saying, that is not the question. Then the police station will know who is thinking some wrong idea. Your number will show in the police office. Suddenly the light will come to the number 31. 31 is caught. It is possible now, technologically possible. And remember, man is so dangerous. Whatsoever becomes technologically possible, he has to try it. He is obsessed. He cannot resist the temptation. The last question. I feel guilty that I can come to you and the poor people cannot come. Don't feel guilty. Please stop coming. Let me tell you one anecdote. Martha was dying. With her last breath, she turned to Abbe and asked Abbe, "Before I die, make love to me just one more time." Abbe answered, "How could you ask me to do such a thing? I will kill you." Martha pleaded, "Everyone is entitled to one last request before they die. You should grant me this last wish." Abbe replied, "Okay." He got into bed and made love to her. No sooner did he finish than she hopped out of bed completely cured and ran downstairs and started to flick a chicken and ail into the living room where her children were sitting, that dinner would be ready in an hour. The children were astounded and ran up the stairs to their father, who was sitting in a chair and crying. They said, "Papa, why are you crying? It is a miracle. Mama is completely cured." He replied, "I know, but when I think what I could have done to and for Eleanor Roosevelt." Get it? "I know, but when I think what could have I done for Eleanor Roosevelt, that's why I am crying." Don't think about Eleanor Roosevelt's and don't cry unnecessarily. If you feel ashamed, don't come. Because to feel guilty is very bad. And I don't want anybody to feel guilty. Then go and serve the poor people. If you want to come here, forget about the whole world. If you think about the world, you cannot listen to me, you cannot understand me. Your life is sad. Your life is really very sad. You don't know whether you are going to exist the next moment or not. And don't feel sorry for the poor. Because in the first place, the poor may not be ready to come. Because I know poor people. I have been traveling in this country. I have been born in this country. I know poor people. Sometimes when they come to me, they come for some other reasons. They never come for the reason I can be helpful. They come, their son is not getting employment, so Bhagwan bless. They come because their wife is ill. They come because somebody is not getting a child, so bless. They come for some other reasons, not for religious reasons. A poor person cannot have religious reasons really. He is starving. His problem is not religious, his problem is physical. Only a rich person can have religious problems. Religion is a byproduct of affluence. It is a luxury. When your bodily needs are fulfilled, then psychological problems arise. A poor man has never psychological problems. You will never see him going to the psychoanalyst. Have you ever seen a poor man? He has no psychological problems. When your bodily needs are completely fulfilled, your problems shift. They take a higher form. They move on a higher altitude. They start becoming psychological. Indians are very happy that they don't have many psychological problems and they don't need many psychiatrists in India. And they think very puzzled why America has so many psychiatrists. And they feel very sorry for America, because they think poor people, they are suffering so much mental illness. They don't understand. A mental illness is a blessing. It simply shows the physical needs are fulfilled. Now the person can afford to be mentally ill. When mental needs are fulfilled, then religious needs, spiritual needs arise. Never before. So if you are feeling sorry for any poor person, don't feel sorry. It is as if you see a small child playing and you start feeling this poor child. He cannot enjoy sex yet. Now it is for you to feel guilty. And if you want to feel guilty, you are free. And if you want to stop making love to your woman or to your man, stop. Because those are small children. They cannot make love yet. They will make love in their own time. Everybody has its own ripening. And if really a poor person has become interested in religion, he will find a way to come to me. Nobody can bar him. There are many poor people here. They will find a way. They will do everything they can do and they will come. Their intensity will bring. Your pity is not going to help them. Only one thing can happen out of your pity. You may miss me. Once a Jew businessman was fishing in a lake when he hauled in a fish of a type he never had seen before. It had golden scales and silver fins which gleamed and flashed as it thrashed about on the bottom of his boat. Suddenly, the fish startled the businessman by speaking. "Kind sir," implored the fish, "throw me back in the lake and I will grant you 3 wishes. The businessman considered carefully and then said, "Make it 5. And we have got a deal." "I can only grant 3, guessed the fish. 4.5. Proposed the businessman. 3, said the fish, barely audible. Okay, said the businessman. "We will compromise on 4 wishes. How about it?" But this time the fish made no reply at all. It lay dead on the bottom of the boat. Life is very sad. I will not be here forever. Use the opportunity that is available to you. And use it as much as you can. Let your inner flame burn bright. And then you can go to the poor people and help them also. That will be some help. Right now, you will feel guilty. They will not gain anything out of your guilt. You will miss certainly. The very, very last question. Is Santa Claus enlightened? If he is not, then who will be? Enlightenment is fun. It is not a serious thing. Santa Claus is a Buddha, is a Christ. Santa Claus is the humor, and enlightenment is humorous. It is nothing serious. It is joy. It is fun. It is delight. Enough for today.